Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Agora Presents The State Part 2, Westphalia. Today we are going to talk about the Treaty of Westphalia and how that treaty has impacted international relations since then. Today we're joined by an all-star cast. We have Zach Twomley of the When Diplomacy Fails podcast, and he did a four-part series on Westphalia. We have Ben Jacobs of Wittenberg to Westphalia podcast. I can imagine that he'll talk about Westphalia. And then we have Travis Dow of many podcasts, but he's particularly has a History of Germany podcast, and he's an all-around German expert. He can tell us a little bit more about himself, that he knows a lot about Wittenberg, Westphalia, the 30 Years' War, and just everything around there. So how's everybody doing?
Pretty good.
Great.
Yay.
And we're just going to jump right into it with a little bit of background on the 30 Years' War and why that was important and what was generally happening in that time period. So, Travis, why don't you just tell us a little bit about get us situated where we are in history and time and place.
Yeah, so the 17th century, let's say, or the early 17th century, or even the 16th century, if you talk about the Holy Roman Empire, it was kind of a mess of this hierarchical, you know, semi-autonomous states. Some of them were some of them were like the lords and counts were Protestant, but most of the population was Catholic. And other places, you had a lot of the population was Lutheran, but the nobility might be Catholic, you know, or that luckily the nobility might agree with you. And then in Bohemia, you had Hussites, like a different brand, another century older brand of Protestants. And with the Austrians ruling them, which were, you know, Habsburgs and staunch Catholics. So you had this, like, mishmash of Protestants and Catholics, basically. And because I lived in Prague, and there's some neat history in Prague, because Prague had some emperors that were very tolerant, like Rudolf II. And there were some people that came there kind of to escape persecution, where they, like Johannes Kepler, was Lutheran, but he lived in Graz for a while in Austria, which was Catholic, and then came to Prague. And Tycho Brahe was the opposite. Like, he was a Catholic that lived in Denmark. He was a Catholic nobleman and ended up in Prague. And then, you know, they ended up being like business partners, kind of. And then some of the, I guess the very, some of the spark that set the 30 Years' War going or alight started in Prague, which was the Second Defenestration. And that is a whole episode actually on the Bohemian podcast.
And When Diplomacy Fails as well.
there you go. And but basically, like, long story short, some Protestants got angry and stormed the castle, just a half dozen, you know, got angry and stormed the castle and chucked a couple of guys out of a window, like Catholic advisors, basically. And they survived, and that started a three-year rebellion. And then the leaders of this rebellion, it was, I mean, there was the Battle of White Mountain, which was a slaughter, and the Czechs lost, the Protestants lost, and Austria took over, and the leaders were arrested. And this is kind of interesting because they were nobility, some of them, most of them, and they were Protestant nobility. And they were tortured and kept in, you know, or at least imprisoned for some 9 months, and then executed in 1621. And that was kind of seen as, that was at least one of the causes that kind of set the whole thing afire, because you can't just execute. It was like 21 Protestant noblemen, and the Catholics just executed them publicly and in a pretty horrible way, actually, some of them. So, and put their heads on spikes and, you know, put the spikes on the bridge and, you know, the whole nine yards, what you do. And that was that. So 30 Years' War happened.
So just to keep this brief, because multiple of us have spent tens of episodes on the 30 Years' War, or we will be spending them. So after the revolt in Bohemia broke out, this sort of touched off a situation where the Protestants and Catholics in the empire had reached sort of, they were sort of at a Cold War kind of situation, and this broke it out into open hostilities with some of the princes of the Holy Roman Empire who were Protestant, picked up the side of the rebels in Bohemia, whereas some other princes who were Catholic supported the emperor, and the emperor had little ability to shift for himself, which is just part of the basic constitution of the Holy Roman Empire. The emperor didn't have too much power, actually, but he got the support of a bunch of the Catholic princes.
Bavaria.
Yes, mostly Bavaria. And the fighting sort of went back and forth. It went mostly against the Protestants, but then a variety of outside forces started getting involved, and this is really the main story of the 30 Years' War, and I'm trying to keep it brief, so I'm not going to give a full blow-by-blow, but things were sort of going against the Protestants, and then the Danes got involved, and then they sort of got... they didn't do too well. And then the Swedes got involved, and the Swedes happened to be... They were in the process of centralizing their country, but more importantly, they were led by a military genius named Gustavus Adolphus, who proceeded to beat the tar out of anybody he came across, at least until he died in battle. But the thing with the Swedes was that they were actually not entirely their own force, because, while certainly Gustavus Adolphus wanted to be involved, he was being bankrolled by Catholic France, who was taking the side of the Protestants, because they were more afraid, and they, I should say, were being led by Cardinal Richelieu, mm-hmm. a cardinal, who was the regent for a... first, who was just the main advisor of a Louis the 13th, and then was the regent, essentially, for the boy king of Louis the 14th later on. And they were more concerned about the fact that the Habsburgs, the Holy Roman emperors, keep in mind, the Holy Roman emperors potentially controlled the Holy Roman Empire, but the Habsburg family also had extensive holdings in Italy, and they... Another branch of the Habsburg family also ruled in Spain, and part of the Spanish holdings as part of Spain was, oddly enough, what we would now call the Netherlands. So the French are potentially looking at a situation where they're surrounded by Habsburg possessions, and they are not overly happy about that situation, and so they start funneling money to the Swedes to fight the Habsburgs. Ultimately, with the death of Gustavus Adolphus, things sort of come down to a very brutal but non-decisive back-and-forth war, at which point the French openly get involved. The French sort of hadn't gotten involved before for political reasons, but also because they were fighting their own Protestant uprising. So they're fighting Protestants with their left hand, yeah. supporting Protestants yeah. with their right hand.
Yeah.
Then the French get involved, continuing to support the Swedes, by the way, financially, but then they also send their own armies in. That pretty much undermines the ability of the Empire to resist. But at this point, so this is 1635, basically, the French get involved. There's some back and forth still, but at this point, everyone's been fighting this war for so long, there's so many parties involved, there's so many issues involved, plus at the core of it, there's religion, which people can't just be like, well, okay, because it's their immortal soul, you know. So it takes them many, many years, basically. The war is eventually settled in 1648 after, depending on who you ask and which country you are, 3 or 4 years of negotiations, at which point I think we can pass things off to Zach to talk about the actual treaties.
Woohoo! Okay. Thanks for that, Ben. That was very good.
Before we even jump into the treaty, we've talked a lot about the Holy Roman Empire and all these different parties, but the Holy Roman Empire was a pretty unique institution at that time. Can maybe Zach tell us a little bit before you talk about the treaty? What was this conglomeration of mess, the Holy Roman Empire, all about?
Okay, sure. Well, I think the thing to accept above all, before you look at something like the Holy Roman Empire, you need to just accept that there really isn't any modern day equivalent of it. Like, some people have tried to compare it to the European Union with varying degrees of success, but I mean, it's just too weird and too kind of complicated an animal to say, like you can do with some old monarchies or dictatorships in the past, whatever.
Yeah. Like, you can draw parallels with the European Union. Sure. Like, every country has its own army, but yet there's a powerless, you know, yeah. Like, you could, yeah, but no, it's totally its own thing.
I think it's important to say that for all these things that we're talking about in this episode, using the word state is kind of an anachronism in general.
Yeah,
even France was a compilation of a bunch of different disparate territories.
Yeah.
Disparate nobles with varying degrees of loyalty themselves. Yeah. I mean, like, yeah. I can't remember who it was that said it, but they said that the Holy Roman Empire was not holy, not Roman, and not an empire. And I think that really says it all. because
it's been attributed to about a dozen different people.
Yeah, I thought that. I mean, it could even just be a historical, like, phrase at this stage. But, I mean, the Holy Roman Empire itself is a weird beast, and this will come up later on, but the fact that it was such a weird beast, it made historians look at it in a certain weird kind of light. Some historians saw the Holy Roman Empire and thought, well, it's so strange, it's not a state, so therefore it was always going to fail. So therefore the Peace of Westphalia meant this. And like, I encountered that a lot in my studies. But back to the original question, if you're going to look at kind of like the makeup of the Holy Roman Empire, I suppose it kind of centers upon the emperor himself, but then there you have the seven electors as well. And within the electors, the electoral college, there's varying degrees of power. And let's just say things were a lot simpler before the Reformation happened, and then split changed what it meant to be an elector from purely like political, maybe strategic reasons into kind of religious. Because now instead of just electors, you have Protestant electors or even Calvinist electors in the case of the Palatinate. And then you have Catholic ones as well. And rather than just a case of who do we elect, now it's a case of whose religion is the electors, and how will that impact the actual election of the Habsburg or not a Habsburg, or is it even right to not elect a Habsburg, that kind of thing. So it's kind of hard if someone it's almost like defining one of those great questions. It's like, how do we even, where do you even start with the Holy Roman Empire? I mean,
well, I ended
it keeps
up
changing. Yeah. I mean, I on my show, I keep redefining it. Cause I'm like, okay, so now, cause I'm still in the early days and I'm like, okay, so here's what it's not. Yeah. It's not the Frankish. It's not, see how it's different. Mm. Okay. Now, you know, let's go to the next century and redefine it again. And I'm still where everybody's Catholic. I'm still in those days where they're going out and conquering pagans.
Oh,
and it's,
sure.
It's still weird because, you know, there's that relationship with the Pope is what that means. So there's always this like, well, we can't get crowned emperor until we actually reconquer Rome for the 10th time and, you know, march into northern Italy. And then we actually have to make it official with the electorate.
Yeah.
But wait, you already had the coronation. Shh, just, you know, go with it.
Yeah.
What? You know?
Oh, it's
so
weird,
yeah,
though.
Yeah. It's a beast. I think that's, you know, long story short, it's
a
beast.
It's an ever-changing beast. And to be honest, every time I think I know what it is, I read a different article and I'm like, well, that's actually a good point. Now what do I do, kind of thing. It's almost like it's like an ever-changing story. And throughout the century, shaped by various events.
I just wonder. I mean, they were just making it up as they went along,
well,
weren't
they? Yeah.
They're just like, because they're all a bunch of illiterates, you know, except for the bishops. Well, everybody's going around and be like, well, you know, how did Grandpa do it? I don't know. I think you went to Pavia, right? Let's go to Pavia. Yeah.
It was an intensely medieval institution.
Yes.
And
yeah,
part of the Middle Ages that you sort of need to understand is that no one was allowed to invent new things. It was always supposed to be...
Well, you're trying to reach back.
Yeah, you're trying
to go back to tradition.
And so, like, the Holy Roman Empire gained its legitimacy as an empire from the Empire of Charlemagne, but what I'm talking about in my show right now is the period between the Empire of Charlemagne and the start of the Holy Roman Empire, with the... And, you know, clearly the entire fabric of European society dissolved for about a century in between that period, but the title survived. And so when people started picking back up the pieces, they were able to say, well, we've got this title, and we've got these political
institutions. Oh, I mentioned that. Somebody in Italy had it. Like, the King of Germany and the Holy Roman Emperor were not the same person for like four generations. Yeah. And then it was like, oh, yeah, wait, if you conquer this city-state... You know, then you're the emperor again, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, okay, right.
Which is why I've spent 10 episodes of my show talking about this random Italian group of nobles called the Gadeschi that are fantastic, but totally ancillary to our show.
And it seems like the thing from listening to all your shows is the thing that really kicked all that, or that, like, the last domino that knocked everything down was that, with the breakdown of the religious cohesion, that there wasn't anything that was holding them together because they were disparate cultures, different languages, different worldviews, and they were held together with this religious idea. But once Martin Luther knocked on the door, then that cohesion fell apart.
I think it might be even more... It was just another thing for the electors to get split about. But with religion, you can't be like, all right,
we'll agree,
you know, I'm not a Hohenstaufen anymore. I'm going to support the Habsburgs now. You have a little bit more firm. You're more firmly welded to your camp.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah. I think what we've all, like, because we've all, even Stephen, you'll probably come across it as well if you haven't yet already, because the papacy and the Holy Roman Empire, of course, they would interchange, like, they communicate and all that kind of thing so often. But I think, like, from my studies, it's almost like people have somewhat avoided the Holy Roman Empire. Would you say that would be fair? Because it's just so complicated and so unlike what we know. And it's really hard to explain. Like, you can't... Like, even if you were to define it in a single sentence, it would only be a relevant sentence for a particular period of that empire's history. And then it changes again.
And I think that's an issue that more broadly applies to this whole discussion that we're having about the importance of the Westphalian treaties. That this whole 30 Years' War period and its aftermath has been sort of very poorly studied up until like the 1980s.
Oh, big time.
Because it just didn't fit in. Yeah. It just didn't fit into any nice narratives. Mm. It wasn't a good and evil story. It was very hard to tell.
Yeah.
And it was only after sort of there was a popular acceptance of ambiguity and post-Heisenbergian philosophy, I guess, that people came back to it and were like, oh, there's like all this information about this period. Why hasn't anyone been studying it?
Yeah, I often ask myself that question. Like, it's kind of like people have, I think a big part of it even has to do the simple fact that most history narratives begin in 1648, taking for granted the fact that an era has ended and that a new one has begun because of Westphalia. And if you were to ask these authors, oh, well, why didn't you look at the 30 Years' War? Surely that would be a great way to connect the old stories with the new stories. And they'd be like, well, the Peace of Westphalia kind of, it's like, it's before.
I think that's how they get away with.
Oh, yeah, big time.
I think that's how they cover up for, like, I just didn't want to deal with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's a whole mess that I just.
Yeah. It's quite clever, really.
So not to cut any corners with that, but let's go back into that ending period right there, the 30 Years' War going into the treaty. You were talking about that.
Sure, okay. Well, I mean, I think the important thing to clarify, first of all, is that the treaties of Westphalia, much like the Holy Roman Empire, are quite complicated, mainly because they drag on for so long. And when I was doing my 30 Years' War special, I thought I'd get them finished in an episode, and I had to use 4 episodes on them, which completely messed up the way my episodes were numbered and really upset my OCD senses. But anyway, so what I ended up doing was, in my most recent ones of looking what was Westphalia overrated or not, I came to the shocking discovery myself that the Peace of Westphalia, it's made up of 2 different treaties, but then there's a separate peace as well. So it all happens in 1648, but the what you have is the treaties of Osnabrück and of Munster, which occur in October 1648, and those are between the Holy Roman Empire, the French, and the Swedes. And then at the start of the year, completely actually not to do with those would be called the Peace of Westphalia, that's in October. And then at the start of the year, you have the Peace of Munster, which is why people, I think, get confused. The Peace of Munster was the one between Spain and the Dutch. And that was agreed to in January, then ratified officially in May. And then the Dutch kind of just drop off the radar and do their own thing. And they don't even send delegates to the actual negotiations happening in Westphalia. What they do instead is they actually send a delegate to the Imperial Diet at one stage, and they basically ask, is the relationship the same? And the emperor says yes it is, and then the emperor sends a communique to the Dutch, and the Dutch just ignore it because they feel like nothing's really changed. I mean, what I kind of came to see was that we've kind of lumped together the Dutch, the Spanish, the French, the Holy Roman Empire, and the Swedes all together, whereas in actual fact the Dutch and the Spanish made peace before the actual Peace of Westphalia took place, which is why when people say, oh, well, the Peace of Westphalia gave independence to the Dutch, in actual fact, the emperor had recognized the separateness and the independence of the Dutch a long time before this Peace of Westphalia had actually been signed. And because of the fact that the emperor was not at war with the Dutch, even though he would have lent mercenaries, etc., to his Spanish cousin, there wasn't really any need to make a peace treaty between the Dutch and the emperor, because like they recognized that in both of their cases it was in their interests to keep on trading and keep their relationship going. That was an inherently good thing. So the Spanish and the Dutch made peace in about May, and then they both separated and went their separate ways, etc. The Spanish had enough to think about. They were still at war with the French. And the Dutch had enough to think about because the English were approaching them with really weird ideas of a union, and they just wanted to do their own thing. So they were more than happy to stay away from the Peace of Westphalia, which happened in October. So yeah, a long-winded answer to your question. The Peace of Westphalia happens in October. The Dutch and the Spanish happen in May, and they're both mostly unrelated, although you could argue that they are in some senses connected.
Well, are you gonna break down what, the Westphalians and the anti-Westphalians?
Oh, yeah.
Like the viewpoint of...
And just to clarify, when I say Westphalians and anti-Westphalians, when I say anti-Westphalians, I don't mean against people that live in Westphalia. I have to clarify that because...
Right.
So the Westphalians would argue that the Peace of Westphalia is all important. It was a fundamentally like era-defining event. Whereas the anti-Westphalians,
yeah.
Now bear in mind, these are distinctions I made up myself. I mean, the two camps do exist, but they don't call themselves Westphalians or anti-Westphalians. It's just handier for me.
No, but that was a good kind of, way of looking at it.
Yeah, I mean, it's better. I mean, in a way, it's good, but in a way, it's bad. I'll explain why it's bad later on. But yeah, so the anti-Westphalians point out the fact. Now, the anti-Westphalians are pretty much led by this guy called Andreas Osiander, whose article in 1998 on like basically why the Peace of Westphalia was a myth kind of went into all the things that made Westphalia a myth, such as what I mentioned there, the fact that the Peace of Westphalia was not a thing happening over 1648. The Peace of Westphalia was an agreement between the emperor and the Swedes and the French, and that was that. And then the Spanish and the Dutch were a separate entity altogether, but so many times historians have forgotten that, so the Westphalians would often lump them all together. The anti-Westphalians say, no, that's not right, because we need to be realistic about the way Europeans saw themselves back then. They didn't see themselves as being lumped together into the same piece, really, just so they could form, like, a neat package that historians can wrap up and say, oh, that's handy, let's keep that there. Do you know? Like, it's
yeah, I think one of the things I have to mention, like, one of the things I took away from your show was when you mentioned the people that actually signed the treaty. I don't remember exactly what you said, but to paraphrase, you said the people that actually signed the treaty, they were not visionaries.
No.
The way that the romantic historians of the 19th century thought they
oh,
were.
Oh, yeah.
Like, no, they didn't sit down and be like, we're not, you know what, guys, we're not going to have any more religious wars.
Yeah.
We're not going to, you know what? What about, we should think about the idea of statehood. Mm. What? No.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they didn't think. Because later they looked back and was like, oh, well, that was where, you know, that was the seeds of nationality, or, you know, nationhood kind of thing. It's like, well, you know.
A lot of stuff got projected onto the treaty that was either, it either came up during the war itself. And usually when historians study wars, they go, and then these people got into a war and stuff happened. And then after the war, and we can talk about the effects. Mm. And the 30 Years' War is a weird one because you actually, if you really want to talk about stuff that developed out of the war, you actually need to get into the war a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And the treaty itself was just a couple documents that got people to stop fighting.
Yeah.
Mm.
And then there was also the stuff that got projected back onto the treaty from later time periods, like you said in your show, based on Franco-Swedish propaganda.
Oh, big time. A lot of the time. And the nationalist historians, even, like, their idea of what Westphalia was, they kind of made those ideas of Westphalia be like the accepted, like be the accepted, like, truth about the Peace of Westphalia and what it all meant. Even when you look at people like Leo Groves, who was this hugely, he basically made the modern idea of the Peace of Westphalia being all important. He kind of imagined that into his article. But the idea, like, all his, like, all the stuff that he writes about, he never even really looked at the Peace of Westphalia's documents. Now, in fairness, they're quite dry. And they're in, like, there. I don't even know if the primary, like, the actual physical documents still exist, but I'm sure that they're digitized somewhere. But what Leo Groves did was he kind of parroted the accepted truths of Westphalia and put them forward in such a way that the parroted truths of Westphalia became, like, the actual law, rather than anyone actually looking about the primary sources, what it actually meant, what these people aimed for and strove for.
Yeah.
Like,
and this gets into that whole scholarship cycle where people weren't looking at this time period at that time, particularly because Leo Groves was an international relations scholar, and not a historian. And, you know, the way this is supposed to work is that the historians come up with sort of the narrative and the facts and everything, and then theorists like international relations scholars sort of go, okay, well, based on this stuff that some historian said, who does all the document stuff and fiddles around with the papers.
Yeah.
You know, now I can extrapolate these ideas. So the fact that Leo Groves told historians what they were thinking is backwards.
It's so backwards. And even the way that we've looked at Westphalia for so long is backwards. Like, the fact that, like, even at the time the treaties were being signed, right, you had French and Swedish propagandists, essentially, and they were talking to, like, they were trying to present themselves as, like, freeing the Germans from under the Emperor's grip. And the Germans that they were trying to negotiate this idea with were like, no, we don't want to be, we like being part of the Empire. I mean, we don't want to be like your satellite states or anything like that. So then it didn't.
It's very nice.
Yeah.
It's a very nice defensive alliance. Thank you very much, big country next to us.
I know, but like, you put it, when you look at it like that, the French and the Swedes couldn't even convince the Germans at the time to abandon the Emperor. And yet, historians later on talking have presented the Swedes and the French as like freeing the Germans from the Emperor, when the Germans didn't want to be freed from anything. They liked their Emperor. They liked their Empire despite everything.
It's actually really, I got one tiny story to tell there, which is really weird if you think about it, which is the Swedish invasion of Prague.
Sure.
Because in Prague, so most of the population and even the Czech nobility were Hussites. They were Protestants, and, you know, they fought their own crazy wars, you know, 200 years prior, like the Hussite Wars. So it's weird. Now, they had the Battle of White Mountain. They tried again. They failed. The Austrians won. And now just a couple years later, I don't know what, a decade later, the Swedes come and they lay siege and the Czechs are there defending Prague against. Like, I would say that, like, aren't the Swedes kind of liberating them in a way? And it's just like, so one thing I would take away from that is, like, it wasn't clear-cut religious, you know, bounds. Like, it wasn't a purely religious war. And, yeah, I mean, if just if someone's trying to make that point, like, there's so much evidence, you know, just like you said about France, that Catholic country, you know, that kind of thing. But, yeah, it's just kind of weird that it was different. Like, even the Czechs defending the empire, like the German Empire and the Austrians and stuff was strange. Yeah. A case of Stockholm syndrome.
Oh, no.
So a huge part of this whole 30 Years' War, and really a lot of the wars beforehand, the 100 Years' War made a huge use of these guys, these mercenaries, who they would fight for money. I mean, essentially, they fought for money, and they were usually a part of a city-state, and they would hire themselves out to different leaders for different wars, as mercenaries do. Ben, can you tell us a little bit about how mercenaries were important in the 30 Years' War and how they evolved through it?
Yeah.
Because obviously mercenaries kind of have a bad name these days.
Right. So if you think about it, there's two ways that you can have soldiers. Only one way we think of these days, which is that you pay them money and they come from your country and they're loyal to you, but you pay them cash. But that's totally different from what they did, at least at the start of the Middle Ages, which is where you had someone who was loyal to you and you paid them in land. Ultimately, that whole transaction shakes out to you can have a professional army who spends all their time either training or fighting, and then they need to get paid. Or you have some sort of levy system where you have militias who spend most of their time making money for themselves based on what you let them do as part of your state. Or you have a landed aristocracy, a military caste, what have you. But really what they're doing with most of their time is managing their farms and their estates and stuff. And then when you need them to fight your wars, you call them up and they show up, maybe, if they feel like it. Over the course of the Middle Ages, and the feudal system that made up the Middle Ages was that latter version. It was a military caste on the land that would show up if they felt like it. Over the course of the Middle Ages, it became more and more convenient to rely more and more heavily on mercenaries. There's a lot of reasons for that. First of all, you don't have to pay them all the time to be training and everything, but then you get professional soldiers, which is nice. And also, just as the economy was more and more cash-based, this became more and more possible. Mm-hmm. The thing that shifted gradually up until the 30 Years' War was that it was less and less just like someone putting out an ad on Craigslist going, wanted dudes with armor. And it became more and more that someone would show up and say, I have 200 well-trained pikemen that are ready to do some service for you if you would like to sign here on the dotted line. And as these companies, which was originally a military term, but took an interesting split at this point because companies became a commercial term as well, and they would do sort of the medieval Middle Ages equivalent of what you'd think of a company doing. Investors would invest, they would sort of incorporate and spread the risk around, they would gather up capital and materials, and then use that capital and materials to hire employees, and then they would try and seek clients. In this case, though, the capital would be arms and food and stuff, and then they would gather together men who had some sort of the employees would be men who had some sort of background in military service. Then they would train them, and then they would seek out clients who would be willing to hire their 200 well-trained pikemen or whatever. And this became more and more of a sophisticated system over the course of the late Middle Ages. And when you got into the 30 Years' War, there are these very sophisticated organizations providing military services for clients. And one of the things that also started to shift was you went from medieval warfare on horseback, where you had a couple dozen of your best friends and relatives who would go out and beat up someone else's best friends and relatives. And you moved into a system where you had gunpowder weapons, you had mass infantry armies. And so in the 30 Years' War, in order to just compete, you needed specialists who knew how to shoot and make artillery pieces, and you needed large numbers of pikemen and arquebusiers and this, that, and the other thing. And all these people needed to be fed, they needed to be paid, and the medieval state, or the medieval political entities that were running things in the 30 Years' War, still hadn't quite built up the capacity to necessarily produce the money and food that was necessary to feed and pay all these people. And so part of the process was that part of the understanding is that they would be paid in loot.
Yeah.
And part of what...
That's key, I think. that should be emphasized. Yeah.
So a lot of why the 30 Years' War is notorious is that you had these mass infantry armies roving across the countryside saying, you know, on the one hand, back to their paymasters, look, you still haven't given me enough money to feed my men. And the paymasters going, well, figure it out, I don't have it yet. And so the CEOs of these mercenary companies would be like, all right, well, just steal everything. Get all the food and valuables that you can get, and we'll pay for more food using the valuables, and then we'll share everything out so that the men eat and that they get some semblance of pay so that they don't just wander off. And the ones that did wander off, well, they would also just steal stuff. And so this was, to a certain extent, in place during the Hundred Years' War. But by the 30 Years' War, you saw this on a mass scale.
Yeah.
And these armies were huge, which is why you saw such devastation in Germany, which is where most of the fighting happened, and most of where these armies went back and forth. And so even, like, the Swedish armies that were the most professional and well-trained and disciplined armies in Europe at the time, they were made up primarily of mercenary soldiers.
Mm.
And so when they attacked Prague, the people in Prague didn't look over the walls and say, oh, our co-religionists, let us welcome them to a Protestant mass.
Yeah.
They looked over the walls and said, wow, that's like 100,000 potential rapists.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, the rapey Swedes are here. It's not about our liberators. No. It's, yeah. Mm. They want to get paid.
Big time. Yeah.
Were these mercenaries? They seem like it was a particular institution to the Holy Roman Empire. Like, a lot of those states in the Holy Roman Empire had these mercenary companies.
Well, okay, so what I know about fast forward a century, like the famous Hessians, that's a whole state in Germany that their gross domestic product was basically turning out, you know, raising their children as mercenaries and exporting them to, you know, the highest bidder. It's just crazy. Like, that, it reached a level of sophistication in the 18th century. And, like, you read about the Hessians in the American Revolution, for instance, right? But rewind a century where we are, there's still, like, Wallenstein, who was, like a general, but also a nobleman. And I mean, he was vastly way more richer than the emperor himself. And he could just afford to pay these armies. So it'd be like, he would be kind of one of the highest investors, because it's still the emperor had to, it's just weird. Like, the emperor wasn't necessarily the one organizing things. It was kind of,
the emperor had the authority.
Yeah, like, noblemen. Like,
the emperor had the authority.
Yeah.
He didn't have the money to actually, like, pay him anything. And the only way he could pay the, like,
but, well, I mean, of course, what's in it for Wallenstein? You know, it's not like, I mean, it's still like he got his back out of this war. So it was still an investment, was what I was trying to say. Like, the emperor was like, he'd say, okay, I'll help you, but I'm getting mine back, which goes back to the mercenary thing of, like, well, how is he making a profit off of this?
He wasn't even like, I mean, in the second episode where I tried to kind of give maybe a revisionist view of the 30 Years' War, my argument was that the emperor was not actually powerful, because even when it came to his allies, he couldn't even pay the likes of Bavaria, Maximilian of Bavaria, like the biggest opportunist in the 30 Years' War, I think. He couldn't even pay him with money. He paid him with land, for example. He gave him, like, part of the Palatinate, as his payment. Same with Wallenstein. He gave Wallenstein the duchies of Mecklenburg and a few other ones as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it wasn't even the case that the emperor, like, was like, oh, I don't have enough soldiers, just take my money. He was like, I don't have enough soldiers, take this land, kind of thing. Like, it was severe, but it comes back to what Ben was saying about mercenaries. It's like, it had reached such a point, and populations and prosperity had reached such a point in, like, the kind of more prosperous hardlands of Germany, I suppose, that when it came time to pay, mercenary captains like Wallenstein were better being paid with land instead of money, because the money, like, wasn't really as reliable. Like, by the end of the war, the Reichsthalers had, like, degraded so much because they'd run out of so much silver and everything else. Land was more reliable than really much stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But if we look a little bit at the background, in particular in the Holy Roman Empire, the big precedent, the most direct precedent in terms of mercenary companies, was the Swiss pikemen, which were very famous, and they actually had a system set up similar to what Travis described with the Hessian.
The Hessian, yeah.
They would, specific states, mostly the Catholic ones, made a regular practice of selling out. Like, they would get people together, and it'd be like, we have too many people. you guys go off, potentially get killed, but make us some money. And then the Swiss, who spent the early part of their political organization time beating on the Holy Roman Emperor, caused the Holy Roman Emperor to turn around and want to create something similar. And so he created the Landschreck system, which was based around smallish aristocrats and free cities that were directly answerable to him rather than any of the princes or anything, and they would raise mercenary companies, and initially they were pretty terrible, but they got better over time, and so there was this slush fund of morally ambiguous men running around in the Holy Roman Empire willing to kill people for money.
Yeah. No loyalties, no, you know, not thinking like, oh, this village is, I mean, yeah, just totally random, you know, miles away from home, or could be from anywhere. So, yeah.
The thing is, what happened to the mercenaries, the reason we don't have mercenaries running around anymore, is that the second side of this equation got better. And it's not that the mercenaries, that everyone went, oh, God, these mercenaries are terrible. It's that the states got better at paying them and basically kept them on retainer forever, and they became standing armies.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't, you know, to cast aspersions on people who joined the military, but, you know, if we stopped paying our standing armies, there'd be problems. The loyalty is obviously something that's very important to the modern military and ensuring civilian control over the military and everything. But the way modern militaries developed was that they brought these mercenary companies sort of into the fold. Louis XIV was one of the first people to do that on a major scale in a major way, because he was one of the first people to really organize a modern centralized state to a certain extent, although it would look horribly anachronistic to us today. But then the British also followed on in the years after the Glorious Revolution, is when some of the first units of the modern British Army were organized, and they were organized as mercenary companies by people who were loyal to William III.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of what happened to mercenaries, basically.
Very
and the mercenaries
story.
they filled a specific economic void that was there, that standing armies were extremely expensive, and civilian militias weren't well trained, and it wasn't really possible to train them very well because they had to go back and milk cows or do whatever mm-hmm. they have to do. So they were, you know, these people who could afford to have an excess of soldiers, well, why not go, you know, make use of them?
And there's just so much that can be said for experience in terms of having a well-functioning army, and a lot of what lies behind the success of military powers like Rome that started out with militia-based systems was that they were just paranoid, militaristic jerks who kept attacking people. And so their militias had a lot of experience, because every year they'd get together and go out and beat up on someone.
The idea of Spartan, Sparta, kind of,
And military castes that developed, you know, a particular social segment, that military was their job and their function.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
And society, that's a lot different than, you know, what was needed during that Middle Ages period or end of the early modern period. Let's talk a little bit about the aftermath of the 30 Years' War. Travis, you had some interesting statistics about the war.
Yeah, because I was thinking, when I was thinking of Zach's Westphalians, the folks that said, well, so the Treaty of Westphalia changed everything. It changed, you know, people no longer use mercenaries. People, you know, it there was no more religious wars. Apart from Ireland, maybe, you know, and that obviously Zach made the point that that's not true. And I kind of listening to that, I kind of had some different thoughts because, growing up in Germany, I would say things did change. Like definitely things changed. I mean, but again, it could be a cycle that people went back and said, well, the treaties of Westphalia did this because that's what we, you know, they separated. Here's the border of Catholics and Protestants. And I don't know, like, you know, it could have been a self-fulfilling prophecy, so to speak. But if you look at Europe as a whole, the 30 Years' War, I think the official statistic is like something like 10% of the population died, which is horrible. And it's not all war-related casualties. It's like famine from the mercenaries, you know, eating all the food and burning and pillaging and all that stuff. So 10% overall. But if you focus down to where all the battlefields are, central Germany and Bohemia and Silesia. Silesia is like the Polish Czech border kind of thing. Those numbers go up to like 30%, like 30% in Germany, up to 50% and in central Germany and Bohemia, and up to 70% in like parts of Silesia, northern Bohemia. So like think about that. Like 70% of the population gone, basically due to war casualties and, you know, famine and that kind of thing. Like that's worse than the Black Death. That's just crazy. And that's, you know, 30 years of, well, it wasn't 30 years in every place, but you'd have mercenary armies going back and forth and back and forth. And, so from a German perspective, I was thinking like, the 30 Years' War is worse than World War One. It's worse than World War Two. Like, what are you talking about? It's like, well, if you were like somewhere in Scotland, you probably lived through those years and didn't notice a whole lot, you know, or in Southern Italy or some such. So it was a pan-European war, but everybody kind of met in the middle in a lot of cases, and just destroyed central Germany. And that border today, so I mean, when I was going to school, there was a crucifix. I went to school in Bavaria, which is southern Germany, and there's a crucifix hanging above the door. And I went to, and it was a public school, but there's a religion class, and you pick whether you're Protestant or Catholic, and you go off and it just, at some point it dawned on me that okay, most of the kids in my class, they crossed themselves after saying the Lord's Prayer. Oh, and you could be atheist and or Turkish, like Muslim or whatever. And then you just go to ethics class. So there was a third option. But yeah, it's like, you know, the majority of the kids like crossed themselves. The Protestants didn't. And I know I went off with like my Anglican, like British friends, or all the Northern Germanies basically went off to Protestant class. And at some point that occurred to me that the no one in that class has a Bavarian accent. It's the people in the Catholic class. And it's just like every once in a while, it's like, oh yeah, that's weird. Like there's two Germanies. Well, there's two Germanies in a different sense, but there's North and South Germany. And there is that border. And it's a huge difference that you see till today in culture and all that. And the North is all the Lutherans. South is all the Catholics.
Yeah.
It doesn't make a huge difference on a daily basis today, I'd say, but you could tell it's there. And me as a kid, if I was going to go ask, like, hey, why is this so? Then someone would say, piece of Westphalia.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, so. I would never, sorry to, I just want to make this point, otherwise I'll forget it. I would never argue that, like, the piece of Westphalia was unimportant religiously. What I would argue is that the problem I have with it is when people look at the Peace of Westphalia and they say it ushered in a new European era of religious toleration. I mean, I know the Holy Roman Empire, it's extremely significant because even us looking back at it, we can see a level of live and let live because it separated the ruler's religion from the subject's religion, which meant that there was essentially a freedom of religion, even though it only extended to Calvinist, Catholic, and Lutheran.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, it's a toleration of religion more.
I mean, it was a level of tolerance that we would recognize as, like, quite insufficient, but for the 1648 Germany, it was immensely, like, tolerant compared to what had occurred before. But what the problem I have with it, I'm perfectly happy to say that it was religiously significant in Germany, the Holy Roman Empire, etc.
I was going to say, on your show, you clarified. On your show, you mentioned, like, if you were in Spain or France, then, okay, first of all, it didn't make that much of a difference, and it was a whole different treaty. I mean, you made the point, like, they signed a whole different treaty that wasn't part of that.
The thing that got me and still gets me is when people who don't really know any better say, oh, it was a religious turning point just for, like, the whole of Europe, and for ages I had
that's exaggeration.
It's a huge mistake because even while people don't understand the Holy Roman Empire, they might say, oh, it made it more like religiously tolerant for like all of Europe without even realizing that it only extended to the Holy Roman Empire, and it was so exclusive to the Holy Roman Empire that you see when the Swedes try to take over more territory, as the Swedes are wont to do, or when the French try to take over Alsace-Lorraine, they have to negotiate with the Emperor and make sure that the Emperor knows, oh no, we are taking this land, Mr. Emperor, but we're not going to try and like impinge on their religious rights or anything like that. And that was purely because of the Peace of Westphalia. I mean, the Germans in the Holy Roman Empire had, what I'm trying to say, they had more religious rights in a sense than any other country after the Peace of Westphalia, because with the likes of France or even in Britain, where you had massive, like, the idea that your religion impacted your loyalty to the state, you had French Huguenots being evicted right up to really, like, the end of Louis' reign. And then in Britain, of course, as well, there was the huge lack of religious toleration in Parliament and the idea that Anglican royalists, like, were the norm. And Charles II, try as he might, couldn't even bring in any religious toleration bills. So, I mean, this is a long-winded way of me saying that, like, the religious aspects of the Peace of Westphalia, very important for the Holy Roman Empire, but its importance is debatable for the rest of Europe. I mean, in time it led...
Don't generalize.
In time it led to more toleration, but at 1648 there was no concept of it, really.
But same with like, they didn't suddenly magically come up with nationhood. They didn't suddenly magically come up with these like grandiose philosophical theories because the people that wrote down the American Constitution did. Mm. You know, these were visionaries. So maybe after the 18th century, they looked back and said, oh, well, the people that signed this treaty were too. And they wanted this religious tolerance and this Bill of Rights. Mm. And no.
Like, the thing is that the people who signed the Declaration of Independence or the Bill of Rights, they had examples at that point of places that were functional and you know,
one and they were romantics in a way.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah. But they had the example of the Dutch Republic, and they had the example of the Holy Roman Empire, where, problematic as it was, society hadn't collapsed into total debauchery and chaos.
Yeah.
It's definitely possible to overstate it, but there's also something to be said for there were no examples or few examples before of any place that had, religious toleration on a widespread scale, at least within Europe. And then now there was
the Hussites, but that was weird. I mean,
well, and the Hussites did.
That was the first example that they kind of set the precedence in a way, but it was still weird. It was like they were still oppressed for sure. So.
And like you said, Travis, in our notes that the Jews still didn't have a seat at the table, and the Muslims who were living in the Ottoman Empire very close, there was still conflict with them, and even the Russians within that sphere, the Catholics and the Orthodox were still fighting at that time. Mm-hmm. So there was still a lot of religious fighting going on. It just kind of simmered it down in Germany. This 30 Years' War was a pretty brutal affair. I mean, millions of people dying in the ravaging of the countryside. Ben, can you talk to that a little bit and fill us in more? And then how did that develop afterwards, the brutality of war, the effect on civilians?
Sure. So a lot of people who, to use our phrasing, a lot of Westphalians would say that after Westphalia, there was a generalized revulsion against wide-scale war like that and the use of mercenaries, and that this led to war being less terrible. I think that's not true in the oversimplified version that I just said. It's not like everyone got together and was like, oh my god, this is terrible, we're going to fire all our mercenaries and soldiers, you need to be better trained.
Yeah.
You can't steal things from civilians. They need food.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I think that after Westphalia, gradually warfare settled into a much more a much less widespread brutality. But I don't think that any of that was intentional, and I don't think any of that was built in. I think it was a creation of circumstances. The biggest thing being that the wars that happened after Westphalia, initially a lot of them were naval wars, and then the big thing was Louis XIV's wars of expansion happened in these fortified zones.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. Yeah,
you might think that in the era of gunpowder that might not make much of a difference, but they'd come up with this fortification methodology called Tres Italian, or you can sometimes see it called Star Forts. But basically, they were these massive, extraordinarily expensive fortifications that were resistant to cannon fire, and it would take you months of shooting at these things to make a dent. And the same processes of centralization and state collection of taxes that allowed them to start having mass-scale infantry armies that didn't necessarily devastate the countryside everywhere they went also allowed the state to start building these massive fortifications, and that sort of requires a different skill set. Also, you don't need quite such massive numbers of armies.
Yeah.
You need more siege engineers and things like that. And so most of these wars that happened were tied up in these sieges for years and years and years at a time, and there wasn't so much roving around the countryside stealing wheat from the peasants. Plus, if you're spending all this time trying to take a city, you're probably going to want to hold on to it. And you probably don't want a burned-over ruin.
Yeah.
That said, there were many times when, you know, if a city didn't surrender after there was a hole punched in the outer walls, then it became this sort of, you know, well, at that point, it's on you what happens to the people in the city, and the soldiers would be let off the chain. And when mobile warfare did happen, then supply lines could get problematic, or if you were in territory that you didn't necessarily want to hold on to, but you wanted to deny it to the other guy, well then, you know, again, totally legit. Just kill the civilians, take their stuff. So it was a lot about circumstances rather than any sort of humanitarian impulse that took the European nobility.
If I could jump in there to kind of clarify as well, like, we kind of, rather than looking at, like you said, we should be looking at the circumstances rather than having this idea that everyone sat down and was like, let's be more moral. Because what actually happened, rather than everyone being like, we should not, like, rob from the peasants, instead, a lot of it has to do with the fact that most of the wars from the end of the 30 Years' War to, like, the early 1700s were all to do with Louis XIV. And that's the area that people immediately study afterwards, and then they get the impression that, oh, look, war changed. War didn't change because Louis XIV said, oh, I don't want to take the money or the food from the peasants. It changed because Louis XIV was surrounded by fortresses, and in order to expand, he needed to take them. So like you said, it was more localized, it was on smaller scales, but also the simple fact that wars didn't last for as long. I mean, they were broken up by periods of peace. I think I've measured it before, between 1667 and 1715, when Louis XIV eventually died, there was 10 years of peace. If you count all of the wars that Louis XIV set in motion, there was 5 in total, and 3 of them were like the larger ones that we would recognize. But like 10 years, 10 can set, like that's all. So even though you could say, like what I just said, oh, there wasn't another 30 years war, in other words, and that's a big part of the reason why the peasants weren't reduced as much as they were before, or the people didn't see war spread throughout all of the lands. It was mainly contained to the French borders, because the French under Louis were the ones that were making the expansions happen. Just like it looked from an untrained eye, it looked like the emperor was the aggressor in the 30 Years' War. Here it looks like Louis is the aggressor in his wars. But at the same time, I would agree with that. I would say that the circumstances changed, so therefore the character of war changed. It is important not to put it into boxes, because like you said, if things did change, if someone's circumstances went from needing to fight an open battle instead of actually fighting a siege, then devastations could happen that hark back to the 30 Years' War. For example, just off the top of my head, in the Palatinate, from about 1689 to about 1691, the French forces pretty much implemented a terrible scorched earth policy in the Palatinate along the Rhine, ostensibly to protect the French border from any incursions, but some historians suspect that there might even have been a religious undertone to it. And as well as that, Louis XIV's sister-in-law, so Louis XIV's brother, Monsieur Philip, his unfortunate wife was Charlotte Elizabeth of the Palatinate. And people think that Louis might have tried to invade the Palatinate because he actually did it in the name of Charlotte Elizabeth of the Palatinate. So this unfortunate wife of Monsieur, as if she wasn't unfortunate enough, being the wife of Philip the Duke of Orleans, at least she wasn't unfortunate enough, but she had to endure hearing about all her homeland being burnt down in her name, because Louis arrived with his French soldiers expecting to take over this area in like basically forcibly like have it seceded to him, but it didn't really work out that way. But yeah, I've kind of gone off on a tangent, but as much as circumstances did change, it is important not to put history into boxes, because when the war did get out of hand, as it did in the Palatinate, it looked just as similar to, just as horrible really, as the 30 Years' War had. So, yeah.
What do you think was the aftermath of, what was the immediate aftermath of this, of the Treaty of Westphalia? Maybe Zach, take that one, since that was something that you talked a lot about.
Well, I mean, if you're looking at the immediate aftermath of the Peace of Westphalia in, say, the Holy Roman Empire, or in the rest of Europe, I mean, the rest of Europe, it's almost like they say, oh, that's nice for about, like, a few years, and then it's almost business as usual straight away. I mean, in the Holy Roman Empire, it certainly did bring in at least a decade of a bit of peace, because there wasn't as much conflict. I mean, the 30 Years' War had ended in itself. That makes the Peace of Westphalia somewhat significant, because it ended years of turmoil that the Holy Roman Empire had gone through. But if you were to look at the likes of other participants in the 30 Years' War, but such as France, obviously we know Louis XIV went on a tear for the next few years and started a load of his own wars. And the same with the case in Sweden. In 1655, there was a There was what was called the Second Great Northern War, or what other people just called the Swedish deluges, because Sweden invaded Poland, took it over, then invaded Denmark, took it over, that kind of thing. The Dutch, of course, were at war with the English for a few different wars, the second and first and second and third Anglo-Dutch wars, which then bled into the Franco-Dutch War. So, I mean, there was no sense of like, oh, there's no more conflict or anything like that. It was more the case that like...
So it's really an arbitrary line where you say, okay, this treaty is the one we're going to emphasize.
But that's what really...
Because you could go forward 5 years or backwards 5 years, and just because, okay, this is the one that... Yeah. Nominally, at least, the 30 Years' War was absolutely a religious war. I mean, the spark that started it, all those events were.
Yeah.
So, which even those that you could argue, like, well, why did Czechs rebel? Well, because they were being oppressed. Yeah. I mean, there were also Hussites and their overlords were Catholic, but they were also just, they were Czech and their overlords were Austrian, too.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, even just...
Yeah, I mean...
Even just the conception of the 30 Years' War geographically is kind of bizarrely arbitrary, because at the same time, the French Wars of Religion were going on, and then there were the wars going on. It was the League of Cambrai in Italy, I think, and then, or I might have the name wrong, but there was a war going on in Italy, there's wars going on in Poland and Russia at the same time, and with the Ottoman Empire, and so these boxes that historians put everything into are, I think they're useful pedagogical tools from a certain standpoint, because we all do sort of need narratives. I think that's like a genetic need for us to start swallowing these things. But we really should recognize that they are arbitrary things. And if we get into study of these things with any kind of depth, there's just all this stuff going on that's completely intertwined.
Yeah.
It's really impossible to separate.
I know. I mean, my whole point was that, even just from the wars I showed you that happened almost directly after the 30 Years' War, in order to understand how they came about, we have to look at the 30 Years' War, or even like disparate events that happened during that period. We can't cut off 1648 and say, well, then that was like the previous era, and now this era, oh, look at all this war, where did it come from? Like, it doesn't make sense if we do that, and that's why I despise when like people put history into boxes, and I don't like the idea of like history starting, like surveys starting in 1648 and then just kind of examining like the likes of the Anglo-Dutch War out of nowhere. Because like that, you wouldn't look at the Anglo-Dutch War and like not investigate the British Republic and say, oh, like you wouldn't just start in 1652 when the first Anglo-Dutch War started and be like, here's the war. I mean, you'd have to look at events that came beforehand, just like you'd have to look at, if you were to look at Louis XIV's wars, you'd have to look at his upbringing and like how his birth during the Fronde and everything else like shaped how he viewed conflict and shaped how he viewed the state and everything else. And even the fact that like he kind of like came to maturity during the period where France was at war with Spain. Like that's like all these things, like history doesn't like separate itself organically into different eras. It bleeds into different eras. So we kind of, like historians themselves, I know they like to tie things into different packages, but we do that at the expense of our own ability to kind of learn and take from history if we do it with the Peace of Westphalia. Because on the one hand, people say the Peace of Westphalia is so significant, but then on the other hand, they're content to leave it behind in a box and not really learn from it. So it doesn't really make sense.
Ben, from an international relations aspect, that we say that we live in Westphalian states and that there's so much tied up into that. What do you think about that whole idea that that's where the modern state comes from?
I would say that, and this is, I would say that that's a shorthand for saying that the modern state system did come from this period, the early modern period, however you want to define that. In my show, I start the early modern period in 1500, and you could go earlier, but you things really crystallize in terms of the modern state around the time of the 30 Years' War, one way or the other. But saying that the state system and the balance of power and all that came about as a result of the Treaty of Westphalia itself is, of course, wrong. I think we've covered that, but it's also, you need to say something. You can't, particularly given how ridiculous the term early modern is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like some jumbo shrimp with my early modern.
Yeah.
But you can't be like, the we live in the post-early modern state system. It doesn't work. But so people say Westphalian as a shorthand. And I think, I'm sure a lot of international relations scholars never dig in deep enough to understand that it's a shorthand, but in terms of their method of inquiry, in terms of their academic discipline, it doesn't matter really where it came from. The point is, states, as we talked about them in the previous state formation episode, the whole monopoly on the use of force, living in an anarchic international community, all those things. That's sort of the important thing. And that method of inquiry, that method of study, that has value. And if people who are doing the study are a little bit unclear on the historic origins in Franco-Swedish propaganda,
yeah,
well, that really doesn't matter that much, actually.
We've started to put together a lot of the pieces, and that the international relations part and the history part are a little disconnected, and there's a big mess of when early modern starts. Zach, what are your takeaways from all this research that you've done, and what else would you like to say about all of this that we've talked about and what you've talked about?
Okay, sure. Well, I think above all, the thing that I really got struck by after looking at all this is the importance of not like taking off our rose-tinted or even scientific glasses, and rather than trying to pick a side when it comes to the Peace of Westphalia, just look at the Peace of Westphalia itself. Like, I don't know whether that means like trying to find primary sources on it, which might be hard, or just try and find as impartial a source as possible, and which is hard to do, because with something like the Peace of Westphalia, because it's held up as so important, it's almost like that importance has stopped people from actually investigating what it actually means. And by that I don't mean like what it's come to mean, I mean what it meant to the people at the time of 1648 who actually signed it, what those people actually thought of like making peace. I mean, I'm sure rather than actually thinking, oh well, this will be very beneficial in the future, because now historians, when looking at this period that we live in now, they can put us into a box and say that before 1648, like, none of this stuff that we're about to sign on the dotted line for existed, and after this period of history it all does. So it's important not to apply our own values and principles to history in general, and I've found that a lot with the First World War as well, but with this period of history, over the centuries after the Peace of Westphalia, Europe, I'm not going to say inevitably, but Europe took a certain course due to a certain series of events. And if we attribute it all down to the Peace of Westphalia and say suddenly after 1648, sovereignty and the balance of power, no more religious warfare, a restricted emperor and all that other stuff that goes along with it, we miss the fact that events like the American Revolution or the French Revolution, or even like the 1848 revolutions and the First World War and events like that, I mean, we miss the impact that those events had on European history as well. It's unrealistic to attribute everything that happened from 1648 and the way in which we view states and statehood and everything else and how they interact, it's unrealistic to attribute all of that to one peace treaty, because as maybe as hopeful as the human beings in 1648 may have been to maintain peace or what have you, they wouldn't have been able to like pass those hopes and dreams down to their predecessors and make sure that, oh, sovereignty was maintained or what have you. Sovereignty and everything else that went along with the Peace of Westphalia, or at least what historians have since attributed to it, it developed organically through human experience. Like, it's not really right in my mind to like say, oh, the Peace of Westphalia caused sovereignty, caused the balance of power. It bothers me as well, because we're viewing history backwards. And I think that's the key thing I took from it. You have to go back to the beginning if you want to understand history. And you cannot say, like, you cannot hold your own views and then apply them to the people that acted in 1648. Because the people in 1648, they were trying their best. Some of them were suffering from gout. Some of them were waiting on letters that they've been waiting on for months. Some of them were, like, they were really annoyed at a particular diplomat in particular. They were sick and tired of being in the Westphalian area for nearly 4 years. Some of them had their own ambitions and dreams and just wanted to make peace. I mean, these weren't idealists, as we've established. They were just average men who were just trying to do their best to make peace. So if we say, oh, they set in motion this grand system, not only are we failing to understand the real history, but we're also giving them way too much credit. So yeah, I think I would give it a cautionary conclusion, what I called it in my mini-series. Look at the history, not the actual values that have since come from that period.
Travis, do you have any final takeaways?
Yeah, I mean, because it's just kind of really interesting that I was trying to think about when I was listening to Zach's show, is like, well, how do I think about in my other shows, for instance, like the History of Alchemy, where I talk about Prague a lot, and like the people that came to Prague because of the culture and how open it was, and there's a very strong pre-30 Years' War and post-30 Years' War, and that's, you know, that's tougher to, that's much more a local history of like Austrian, you know, the Habsburgs and the German emperors and that kind of thing, and why they chose Vienna as a capital or Prague as a capital or this or that, and it's really local. If you look at that local history, then oh yeah, you see, I mean, it's night and day. You see a huge difference. It's like looking at the layer between post and pre Black Plague, mm-hmm. you know, kind of thing. But if you try to extrapolate and you know, oversimplify again and say, well, there was you know, there was a economic downturn, and I mean, it reached from Ireland to Russia or something. Or that they had these grandiose philosophical ideas, then it doesn't make so much sense. But still, I mean, personally, I always found it I did learn something from Zach's miniseries too, which was, because personally, I did find it a huge, or even in my own life, going kind of along the lines of what you said, is like you see an event and you wonder, well, how did it get there? So you have to go backwards yeah. in time, and you know, why did this happen? And in my own life, I look at a map of religious boundaries, and I see that Bavaria and Baden-Württemberg are Catholic, and Austria and Switzerland. Well, Switzerland, not necessarily, actually. And then North, you know, is the you know, why is the North Protestant? Oh, well, that's Prussian. Well, what does that mean? Oh, well, that's where Martin Luther was. That's, you know, oh, well, okay, well, you know, and then just these questions come and you start going back and back. And a lot of times it's like, well, damn it, because they signed the Treaty of Westphalia and that's where it is, yeah. okay? Oh, okay. And that's where the questions end, yeah. you know, at least to a 10-year-old or whatever. But that kind of makes sense. So then people kind of say, well, it is because it is that way now. If you look at this these boundaries, it's because they signed this treaty and everybody was happy. You know, there was religious toleration. So yeah, it's an easy answer, but yeah, if you look, underneath, the surface, then you find it's much more complicated. I always just, I don't know, just, you know, from my own personal history, I always look at an era and think, how were the Jews doing, quite frankly? Were they being oppressed? Were they more open? And even here, I didn't bring that up on this episode because they were more emancipated. The Jews had a better time in the Netherlands mm. after their treaty with Spain. But probably in the long run, I mean, yeah, then you start getting into the what ifs. But they didn't necessarily have a better time in Germany, maybe initially, because you have this idea of religious toleration. But not really. You have this idea of, well, Lutherans are okay now along with the Hussites, but anybody else is, you know, because Lutheran means you're Prussian. Catholic means you're Holy Roman Empire. Well, you know, you're good. You're part of Christendom. But there was still no room for Jews in there. So there's still, you know, they were better in some areas, worse in other areas. So what kind of answer is that?
Sure.
You know? Yeah, it's just it's an interesting time. I think it was a brutal war. It was I don't want to over-exaggerate to all of Europe, but in central Germany, it was brutal. Whole villages were wiped out. Villages starved to death. Women and children were massacred. And yeah, I'm sure there's over-exaggeration. And even at that time, there's a certain propaganda, but atrocities happened on a massive scale. It was a desperate sort of like total war sort of situation in a way, or just yeah, like brutalities happened that maybe that area didn't see those types of brutalities after, like Czech Republic maybe, or, you know, Bohemia and Silesia and that kind of thing, for a couple centuries. So maybe for them it was like, oh, well, here's a new era, you know, era of peace. Whereas, like you said, in the Palatinate, like French were going to town. So, again, we could fill hours. I gotta say, I did really enjoy Zach's miniseries. I gotta emphasize to the listeners of this show to go listen to that. He did a great job. Nice. I think if you add them all together, it's like, what, 4 hours of this topic. So,
yeah,
you know, we don't want to rehash everything, and we can't do it justice. I mean, definitely go listen to that. Ben is gonna, I mean, Ben's whole podcast is kind of going to,
I mean, eventually my whole podcast
come together.
My whole podcast is predicated on this anti-box stance.
Yeah,
basically, I was gonna do a history of the 30 Years' War, and then I was like, well, I can't. There's like all these other wars going on at the same time. I need to do other stuff too.
And even in the title of your show, you know, you're like from Wittenberg to Westphalia. Westphalia is a line in the sand.
It's a cutoff point.
Right.
You know?
Right. But then I say in the first episode that I'm not actually going to stop.
Yep. And you're like, actually, the scope's way blurrier. And whatever I want.
I'm probably going to go up to the Glorious Revolution and then talk about the colonies. And
if this topic is interesting, there's a lot more out there for you. That's for sure.
Time.
And if you do want to learn more, Zach, where can we learn about your show?
Well, I mean, if you want to learn more about the Peace of Westphalia,
of course you.
I did a 30 Years War special about 3 years ago now, and I also did recently. WDF Asks, we did a special on Is Westphalia Overrated. It looks at the Westphalian, the anti-Westphalian, and then ties it all together. It's quite digestible, but you can find it if you just simply search When Diplomacy Fails. I mean, it's the most recent episodes. You can also go to www.wdfpodcast.com, and all the episodes are up there. Simply click the sidebars and stuff. So, yeah.
Ben, can you add a little bit more to what wrap up a little bit, and then you can share how we can get in contact with you.
Sure. So I guess my big, all three of us could probably keep talking for several more hours.
Yeah.
I know I could, but I think the big summary thing is just, I want to talk a little bit about the historical process, in that I mentioned this a little bit before, that the historian goes back to all the primary source documents and does their thing, and then pushes conclusions and narratives out to theorists on the one hand, like international relations scholars, but then also out to the general public. And part of the process there is that you have people who aren't necessarily historians, but who often are, who write popular histories that are more digestible, that people who don't have specialized training and access to academic sources, that they can take it in, and it's a little bit easier to deal with. And admittedly, popular history is usually about 10 to 30 years behind the curve, but it's an important part of the process. And the two big takeaways from this discussion I would like to say is, first of all, that there's a lot going on in the academic community about this era. The early modern era is intensely important right now in academic work that's going on. And the other thing I wanted to say is that, so there's a lot to be learned. It's a very exciting time. And then the other thing I'd want to say is that podcasts are sort of a very important part of the popular history landscape right now. Yeah. And so the three of us are doing our part to try and bring what's going on in academia out to you unwashed masses. And so I hope you appreciate us, because these guys are great. And anyway. So that's the big takeaway, is that there's a lot of exciting information out there right now, and I'm really excited to be part of this conversation and part of this wider conversation to bring this material out to people.
And Ben, where can we learn more about your show?
And if you want to find out more about my show, I'm at my website is www.wittenbergtowestphaliapodcast.weebly.com, and I'm on iTunes, I'm on all the podcatchers, so look me up. Glad to have you. I swear I swear I'll get to the Wars of the Protestant Reformation at some point.
Great. And Travis, how
yeah,
can
so
get
if you like the time period, I do a history of alchemy show, which ends up being a lot of like history of science, granted, but in the early modern period. And then Bohemican, which is all about the Czech Republic. We've done several shows, the Second Defenestration, the topics around the 30 Years' War. I was a ghost tour guide where there was like torture chambers, where actually they tortured the noblemen that were beheaded that sparked the whole war, and then also was used as dungeons in the 30 Years' War. So there's like graffiti from like, you know, 1620s, 30, or whatever it is. It's just like really neat stuff. And so that's on Bohemican. And then, I do the history of Germany. So I'm not quite to this time period yet. I think I'm somewhere, where am I now? There's Saxons, Luther, what? There's Saxons and Franks somewhere, so I'm in the 11th century, so I still got a ways to go.
Just a bit.
Jeez. I started with Neanderthals, so I went from like 40,000 BC to, so I'm already in the 10th century, 11th century, so that's good.
You're doing way better than me.
So all of those you can find on podcastnik.com. That's podcastnik.com. But we do start going, a lot of the origins of the HRE and how it kind of changed from Charlemagne's time to the Saxons to the, you know, and how the Pope is involved. I think I'm going to have Steve Guerra on the show here pretty soon to talk about the investiture controversy so if you're interested in the Holy Roman Empire and all of that stuff, we are covering that. So, again, that's podcastnik.com, podcastnik.com.
Well, I thank everybody for being on. I think this was a great conversation. I, of course, have been Steve, the host of the History of the Papacy podcast, and we are all members of the Agora Podcast Network. This month's Agora Podcast Network Podcaster of the Month is Dominic from the History of Egypt podcast. You should definitely check out all of the great Agora Podcast Network shows at agorapodcastnetwork.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.